Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure to welcome you back to the Middle East Center for the Friday evening seminar. My name is Eugene Bergen, and as director, I want to first express my thanks to our colleagues and partners at the Refugee Studies Center for making tonight's event possible, and to Anne Irfan in particular. And of course, returning to her Oxford roots with her post at the Refugee Studies Center. It's really fun having you back, and we look forward to doing lots more together. We are, of course, very pleased and honored to be hosting tonight's event. And for once, what I'm about to say is not said to elicit a quick laugh from you, but we live in times where things that would have been unthinkable are now becoming normal. And having watched the rollout of the Trump vision for making peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis, it was shocking enough to see the content, but yet more dismaying was to see how little response it provoked from a world that has grown so used to the undermining of the standards by which one talks about conflicts, by ways in which one addresses the historic roots of conflicts, and more fundamentally, the laws that are intricately involved in international conflicts. Such a rampant disregard for context and history and law was not a coincidence, it was a strategy. And it was strategy by someone whose vision of conflict resolution is closely tied to trying to buy people off economically with what they won't give them politically. And of course, such a short-sighted vision is going to be still born. Very quietly, the European Union has rejected the Trump plan, and one listens in vain to find voices in support of it. And yet the strong pushback, the strong blowback that one might have expected from so outrageous an abandoning of long-standing legal positions, we're waiting to hear that too. How important is it then to have appearing now a second edition of a book which has really come to define the rights and positions of Palestinian refugees in international law? Since first published in 1998, Palestinian Refugees in International Law has truly emerged as a classic in its genre, written in a way accessible to legal scholars and non-legal practitioners alike. It has enshrined in common legal language certain positive things that are beyond debate or question. But since 1998, a great deal of water has gone under the Allenby Bridge, and it was definitely time to revisit the way in which the legal position of Palestinian refugees has been transformed in subsequent years. To do so, Lex Takenberg has partnered with Francesca Albanese, and we are so delighted to have both here to speak to the new edition of their book. Francesca is an international lawyer and an affiliate scholar of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University, though she hastens to add, not based in Washington, D.C. She prefers to work in her university and write on her subject from the safe distance of Southeast Asia. Reasonable.
Yes.
And Lex Takenberg, lately chief of the ethics office of UNRWA in Amman, has recently retired and is now making life between Vienna and Amsterdam, is that correct?
Toulouse countryside.
Of course, the French countryside in Vienna. But tonight we have you with us in Oxford. We are so delighted to have you here. We welcome you both. The plan will be for Francesca and Lex to introduce their book. They'll have a conversation between them. We'll broaden the conversation with Anne and me coming in with some leading questions before we open the floor to you. And then at the end of our proceedings tonight, I'd like to invite all of you to join us for a reception to celebrate the pre-publication of the site. With no further ado, I hand over to our speakers. Please welcome Francesca.
Thank you very much, Eugene. I hope you can hear me. It's really a great honor for us to be here this afternoon for the first presentation of the new book. So let me begin by thanking the Middle East Center and the Refugee Studies Program, and the two of you in particular, Anne and Eugene, for agreeing to host the event and for making all the arrangements. As I said, it's particularly exciting to be here, as it will be kicking off a series of book launches in the coming in the remainder of this year. We're very happy to have a representative of Oxford University Press here, our publisher, and we very much look forward to see the book in print in about 3 months from now. We're also very happy to see so many friends, scholars, others, former colleagues. Thank you so much for coming here today. A special word of appreciation to Nicholas and to some others who supported us so much during our research and writing. It means a great deal that you're here today. When the first edition of the book was written, originally as my PhD dissertation, and written during my time in Gaza with UNRWA, there was relatively little legal literature dealing with the Palestinian refugees. There was lots written about the Israeli conflict, specifically about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including legal works, but very little specifically about the people at the heart of the unresolved conflict. And I remember very well that as a young lawyer, initially working with the Dutch Refugee Council, and then with UNRWA, I had considerable difficulty in understanding why Palestinian refugees were the only group of forced migrants that were enjoying a special status under the international refugee regime. I tried to figure out what that meant, and that was a key motive of making it the subject of my PhD dissertation. And the book then became the first to comprehensively analyze the various legal aspects of the Palestinian refugee question and their distinct status in international law. The first edition, written in the wake of the Oslo breakthrough, published in 1998, I was indeed in the middle of my research when the news of Oslo broke, reflected the optimism of the time, including the expectation of the establishment of a Palestinian state, which in turn would be instrumental in bringing about a resolution of the refugee question. This optimism, as we all know by now, was unfounded, and almost every development since the Oslo breakthrough has adversely affected Palestinians, including the refugees, and I mention a few. The matrix of control established by Oslo, accompanied by the progressive encroachment of the Israeli occupation on territory foreseen as part of the Palestinian state, the divide between Fatah and Hamas and the impossibility of reconciliation so far between the two, the 11-year-old medieval blockade of Gaza on Gaza and 3 devastating Gaza wars, the oppression of Palestinians in the West Bank with settler violence and frequently reported excessive use of force by the Israeli Defense Forces, the rise of the right and nationalist and settler-supported parties in Israel, and finally, a worsening of the situation for Palestinian refugees in many of their countries of asylum, Iraq, Libya, and Syria, but also changes of migration policies in Gulf countries and refugee policies in the West. One of the most visible recent developments affecting the Palestinian refugees has been a change in approach of the United States, which is no longer perceived nor claims to act even-handedly in its engagement with Israel and the Palestinians. The defunding of UNRWA and the recently unveiled deal of the century bear testament to this. Amid those challenges, there are also a number of more positive developments that occurred over the last 2 decades and that represent important opportunities. There is today much greater awareness of the Palestinian refugee question than when I was researching the first edition. There has been an increase in academic and expert studies on the subject, and I'm very happy to see some of the key scholars today in the audience, Don Chetty, Avi Schleim, Gada Karmi, Abbas Shiblak. We have very gratefully drawn on your analysis and that of many others in updating, in writing the new edition. A rights-based discourse concerning the question of Palestine has gained traction, prompted by the legal work of Palestinian and international NGOs and human rights mechanisms, the 2004 advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice on the legal consequences of the war in the West Bank helped their work by authoritatively elucidating the international legal framework applicable to the Israeli occupation. The ruling was a key trigger to the call for BDS, boycotts, divestment and sanctions, launched exactly 1 year after the ICJ opinion was issued. which amongst other things reiterates the right of the Palestinian refugees to return. The growing opposition to BDS around the world bears testament to the power and appeal of its message as the Palestinians' non-violent cry for justice. Further, there has been greater scrutiny of Israeli policies and practices in the occupied Palestinian territories. UN bodies, fact-finding missions in Gaza, also in Syria, UN treaty bodies and thematic rapporteurs have exposed violations of basic rights of Palestinian refugees, including outside the occupied Palestinian territory. This has also advanced the interpretation of international law with reference to Palestinian issues and identified violations potentially attracting individual criminal liability in addition to state responsibility, which acquires new relevance through the possible ICC investigation of the situation in the OPT. And last but not least, there is greater awareness of protection vulnerabilities of Palestinian refugees and a clear resolve to make international protection of Palestinian refugees a reality, including through greater and more systematic cooperation between UNRWA and UNHCR. When I wrote the first edition, colleagues in UNRWA's legal department told me, you know, UNRWA does not do protection. You know, why does there have to be a protection chapter in your book? And this has greatly changed over the past decades, and I'm very happy for those developments. So having closely observed these various challenges as well as opportunities, well, you know, I continue to work with UNRWA in the region, in the Near East. It gradually dawned on me that it would indeed be important to update the book. However, as much as I saw the relevance, I dreaded having to embark on another couple of years of solitary confinement to accomplish the task. And it was Professor Guy Goodwin-Gill, well known to many of you, who suggested that I consider partnering with a co-author, as he had done for the subsequent editions of Refugees and International Law. I liked the idea and began to look for a suitable candidate. And this turned out to be quite a challenge, and it took a couple of years. Not only was I looking for a good lawyer, but he or she needed to know and understand the history of the Palestinian refugee question, be well versed in various areas of relevant international law, a good researcher and a networker, as there was a lot of new literature to process and to incorporate and to react to, and many more engaged on the issue than 20 years ago. And last but not least, I was looking for someone who had their heart in the right place with a good understanding of the Palestinian refugee question. Now, after some time, you know, and having worked with Francesca during her tenure with UNRWA as a colleague, I felt she might fit the profile. But when I asked her, she initially declined, and it took patience and perseverance to convince her to reconsider. And I am very grateful she did, as I rapidly found out that she was indeed the perfect choice. Not only did she agree to be my partner in crime, but she accepted to act as the principal author of the new book, taking the lead in the drafting of what essentially became a new manuscript. My role was to offer strategic and academic support, to brainstorm with Francesca on how to tackle dilemmas we encountered on the way, to tap into my extensive network of academic and other contacts relevant to the book, and last but not least, to review, revise, and comment on the various drafts. It was a totally different experience than the mostly solitary exercise that the writing of the first edition had been. And the result is a much, much better book, reflecting the wealth of knowledge we were able to tap into. So as Francesca has been the lead author, it's only fair that I ask her to present the book to you. Francesca, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Lex. Very good. Saying thank you, Lex, for the touching introduction. Yes, it was an extraordinary partnership, I can say. And I think that this work, which will be in print in 3 months, bears testament to it. I would like to echo Lex's words of thanks to Eugene and Anne and the Middle East Center and the Refugee Studies Center for hosting this talk, and to everyone in this room. It means a lot to us to have so many friends, someone also coming from Scotland to be with us, from London, and new and familiar faces. It's a lot at the end of this journey. And before I present the book, so that I also get the tension out, because the last thing you want to see, it's a tense person talking about international law. And I want to share a personal reflection just on what he said, to qualify my reluctance to engage with him in this project. This is such an understatement, because it's true. It took me 2 years to accept the proposal. And this is not because I was not flattered. Yes, I was. Having worked with UNRWA and having worked with and on Palestinian refugees, I knew far too well how indispensable, how necessary it was to have another edition to Lexa's book. But the point was, why me? I mean, as a legal practitioner, as a human rights lawyer, I was very happy and comfortable with using academic research in my own practice, in my own training. I've never thought to be the one producing research. And the other thing is that I really feared embarking on research on a matter as poignant and charged emotionally and politically like the Palestinian question, on which I had deeply personal views. And I feared that it could compromise my objectivity. Eventually, much introspection and discussions with colleagues after, I was swayed by the belief that one can and actually must be ethically and principally committed and yet remain objective. And the legal research and the practice are not so different. So I also realized that I needed to see for myself why international law, particularly in the case of Palestine, appears closer to power than to justice, as our friend Victor Catan argues, and how to make the case that subordination to consideration of political expedience and geopolitical convenience is not an immutable characteristic of international law. It can and should be undone. So 70 years of impasse demonstrate the necessity of to apply international law to the Palestinian refugee question, but also the impossibility of doing so without principled political support, which is what is lacking. So my hope is that our legal research would contribute to stimulating and mobilizing that support. And this was ultimately what convinced me to be Lex's partners in crime, as he colorful depicts me, and why I'm here. So now that the tension is gone, let's go to our book. So those who are familiar with Lex's first edition will recognize the old implantation in the new edition. Our book remains, in essence, an analysis of the old Palestinian refugee question from a legal perspective. Among the subjects we treat, there are the definitions of Palestinian refugees, because the first problem you encounter is, who are Palestinian refugees, how to define them, and the origins and evolution of the Palestinian refugee question still present day. And I would like to insist on that, because lawyers tend to not to delve into the history, start by the facts, and assume that what others have said is fine, so let's refer to them. For us, having built in our book an actual historical perspective was necessary to make the reader understand the relevance of international law as it stood at the time when the Palestinian refugee question arose, to capture the continuity between the past and the present, and to appreciate characteristics and dimension of the Palestinian displacements and their legal meaning. So we examine how various branches of international law are relevant to Palestinian refugees, the special arrangements that the United Nations took to deal with this group of refugees, which explains why UNRWA is what it is, and what kind of protection it can and cannot ensure to Palestinian refugees. We assess the status and treatment of Palestinian refugees around the world. We have mapped 50 countries, because I already had the sense that we couldn't argue that Palestinian refugees are something, are a phenomenon confined to the Middle East. They have long ceased to be so, but I had no idea before we started surveying countries, and we have surveyed 70 countries to get information. We had no idea the presence of Palestinians had got into such further places and exploring new frontiers. And eventually we discuss the extent to which international law is relevant to the pursuit of just and durable solution, and meanwhile to ensure protection of Palestinian refugees. And we also try to give meaning, to find meaning to the inconclusive rounds of negotiations that have taken place under the auspices of the United Nations first, and then through bilateral, multilateral and bilateral channels, so as to identify the missed opportunities and to bring justice to Palestinian refugees. Also identify what we hope are new opportunities. So instead of summarizing the contents of our book, because I really would like to keep you awake until the end of this 25 minutes, I would like to give you an impressionistic sense of the book. So we adopted what we call a holistic approach, one that allowed us to consider, as I said, the relevance of international law over time, and to show the importance of the connection between them. This gives legal context to the violations that Palestinian refugees have experienced over the last time. And let me start by giving you some examples. International humanitarian law. This is the law that rules situations of armed conflict. It was relevant at the time the Palestinian refugee question arose, because of course it was born out of conflict, and it's relevant today. Palestinian refugees have been protected person and are protected person in a number of contexts, and so should have been protected as such, for example, in Lebanon and during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and in Syria and in Iraq, in Libya. Has it happened? We analyzed to what extent it has happened, to what extent it has not. We stress the importance of international humanitarian law because certain violations of these bodies of law may entail individual criminal liability, which is an important thing to keep in mind for the Palestinian refugees in the diaspora, because those who can access universal jurisdiction this represents an important avenue for justice. And it's also important in the context of the ICC investigation, hopefully it will take place. And then we discuss the relevance of the law regulating nationality and statelessness for Palestinian refugees. And again, it's the history and the present. Historically, Palestinian refugees held British mandate citizenship as of 1925. As such, under the principles and law of state succession, they should have been given the opportunity to elicit citizenship in Israel after the creation of the state, this was an obligation of Israel as the successor to the British Mandate Palestine. Instead, there was a denationalization en masse whose effects are still lingering. And more sensitively, we use the framework to protect stateless person to discuss the enduring Palestinian statelessness, unpacking not only the sensitive matter of Palestinian nationality, separating its legal meaning having a citizenship, a passport of a state, from its ethno-political meaning the sense of identity, the bond with a community, with a national group. Because in the Middle East, you almost cannot say that Palestinians are stateless, which has legal implication, because this also links to the question of the state of Palestine. A number of Palestinians arriving from the Middle East and seeking asylum in Europe see their application for protection, for asylum, rejected because they are citizens of Palestine. No, they're not. They're stateless for the purpose of international law and should be protected as such. So in a nutshell, we argue that Palestinians, unless they've acquired citizenship of an independent and sovereign state which has a citizenship law, remains stateless. Then we examine how international human rights law, which is enshrined in the Convention on Civil and Political Rights, Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, etc., can serve to better protect Palestinian refugees. It is very important because this body of law has not necessarily broader scope of protection, but it's more broadly ratified than other instruments, especially in the Arab regions where most Palestinian refugees still live. And this has an immediate impact in the way they articulate also their protection, but also I will give you an example. In recent years, various states party to these human rights treaties in Europe and Arab region have received a recommendation point to the way they treat Palestinian refugees and recommended measures to correct arbitrary and discriminatory practices toward them. For example, something that the treaty bodies picked was the fact that the denationalization, the frequent denationalization of Jordanians of Palestinian origin, which would happen against the law, against international law, against Jordanian law, and based on arbitrary decisions and probably secret administrative circulars we are not given to know. The only judge that was looking into the matter has been removed. And also the treatment of Palestinian refugees from Syria in Egypt and Jordan, the treatment of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and Palestinian refugees from Syria in Lebanon. These are things that have got into the vein of the human rights system. I remember 10 years ago when I went with my UNRWA colleagues to meet with treaty bodies at an annual meeting and special rapporteurs to question why when they investigate the report, when they prepare their reports or when they study state reports, they never notice conspicuous Palestinian presence and often the fact that this presence is also associated with mistreatment and abuses. And you would be surprised, or maybe not, I was to hear from lawyers, from human rights experts, oh, but there's UNRWA protecting them, or it's a political issue. No, it's a legal issue. These people have rights. And I'm happy to see 10 years down the line, also thanks to the work of those who submit reports pointing to the situation of Palestinian refugees, some outcome. Last but not least, the relevance of international refugee law for Palestinian refugees. The fact that Palestinian refugees do not fall under the mandate of UNHCR and there is instead UNRWA serving them mistakenly leads many to believe that Palestinian refugees are not legitimate refugees and are entitled to sort of lesser protection than others. In fact, even if they're protected through special arrangements, different institutional arrangements, they are refugees like anyone else, internationally recognized refugees. And we do explain why so, because if we again don't look at the history, why the system was conceived this way, we cannot understand the present and this anomalous, what looks an anomalous situation. So in 1949, while the drafting of the 1951 Convention and the UNHCR statute was being finalized, the General Assembly had already decided how to solve the Palestinian refugee question. How? By creating the United Nations Conciliation Commission for Palestine. May I ask you how many have heard of the UNCCP? Wow, yeah. I've never seen so many.
But in this crowd.
Yes.
I mean, it is a minority.
You're still a minority from this perspective, but it's great. But however, how many of you have heard of UNHCR? How many of you have heard of UNRWA? I'm just trying to make the point. So the thing is that there was this body which was the one mandated to solve the question of Palestine and a part of it to deal with the Palestinian refugee question. Not only that, Resolution 194, which I'm sure you are familiar with it being the resolution about the refugees. It's not. It's a peace plan which walked on the heels of Resolution 181. But however, had a durable solution scheme for Palestinian refugees. Those who are keen to live in peace with their Jewish neighbors would be allowed, should return to their homes. And those who were not keen to return should be allowed to resettle elsewhere and compensated. This is what was established. As you know, peace was not attainable in the short run, and so other mechanisms to provide relief and assistance to Palestinian refugees were created. The most lasting one is UNRWA. So one cannot understand the system made of UNRWA without having in mind the role of UNCCP. The General Assembly wanted to grant it the same, if not higher, protection for Palestinian refugees. The lack of peace, the lack of attainable peace, has meant that little by little, UNCCP has been simply demised. I say that it's in a state of induced coma because it still exists, but it's not operational. It issues once a year a report saying that nothing has changed. But, and this has been from the mid-60s, while the negotiation attempts had stopped already in the mid-50s. But however, UNRWA's role was complementary to that of UNCCP, because it was to provide relief and assistance to the Palestinian refugees, but also support UNCCP work in the in reaching solutions. This is the system that Article 1D of the Refugee Convention encapsulates. If we read Article 1D now, it reads really odd, because it excludes Palestinian refugees from the pursuit of the 1951 Convention, because they are protected. It says persons protected by other UN entities, UN agencies, so the Palestinian refugees and others whose refugees status has been solved. But however, but they fall under the scope of the convention and benefit from the convention if this assistance and protection ceases for any reasons. So if there is UNRWA and UNCCP, they're excluded, but if UNRWA and UNCCP are no longer there, they will benefit from what? From the institutional arrangement that the system, the refugee system back then had envisaged, meaning UNHCR. The drafters of the 1951 Convention did not mean to exclude Palestinian refugees from the enjoyment of substantive rights. Think of it. In 1951, Palestinian refugees had already been admitted in the countries where they took de facto asylum. They were not treated as badly as Palestinian refugees who flee today, who are pushed back. And also, the need for ensuring legal protection, as it was for other refugee groups, like World War II refugees from Europe, was not as acute, but because other countries had been at least welcoming in receiving these refugees. But they wanted, the Arab states were very strong in demanding a return of the refugees, because this was the logical solution for them. Since the demise of the UNCCP, the debate has been consumed by who's the body responsible for Palestinian refugees. And unfortunately, I think that the debate, while contributing to make understand the protection tragedy around the Palestinian refugees, has also held back some conception of protection. Because meanwhile, since UNCCP ceased to operate, UNRWA has evolved its functions in a way like UNHCR has evolved to respond to human necessity in order to fill a vacuum. And also the cooperation with, especially as of the early 2000s, the cooperation with UNHCR has become much more tight, and with the aim of serve in the spirit of continuity of protection for Palestinian refugees. What I would like to add is that in 1949, it was not odd at all to have ad hoc responses to refugee crisis. If you think of it, even the 1951 Convention was not the universal convention that we know today, and so UNHCR mandate was not to deal with all refugees, because there were also the Korean refugees, 14 million Indian Pakistani refugees, and they were not under the purview of the convention or UNHCR mandate. This is because the norm back then was there is a refugee crisis and there is a body, an ad hoc body, dealing with it. Today it's not the norm, but this is because no one 70 years ago would imagine the Palestinian refugee question would last seven plus years. So our book examines the role in cooperation, the roles of and the cooperation between UNRWA and UNHCR, and how international refugee law applies to Palestinian refugees, including with its development, which brings us to consider also the kind of opportunities that the New York Declaration, which was unanimously endorsed by the General Assembly in 2016, may offer for Palestinian refugees. So the relevance of the various branches of international law that I just described, and I promise that this is the last thing I say about international law, is that it details a number of fundamental rights the Palestinians are granted under international law, and makes particular relevance based on the regional and country-based assessment that we have carried out. As I said, I think that for the first time, at least to our knowledge, we have presented the most comprehensive overview of the Palestinian dispersal. Because we have surveyed, we have attempted to survey 70 countries, and eventually we had 50 to talk about. 50 countries, Palestinian refugees are in 50 countries. So it's clearly not a phenomenon confined to the Middle East. And they're not even a phenomenon confined to Europe and North America, as it, we would have thought until, so this was until maybe the 70s. Already in the 70s it started to change, and so as of the 80s, and as of the beginning of the centuries, the most dramatic exodus that you can find is now toward areas where Palestinians have no diasporic ties, and often there is no asylum, a refugee protection scheme in place. I can tell you, I mean, the fact that I was based in Indonesia allowed me to see directly the situation of Palestinian refugees. There have been 3,500 Palestinians arriving in Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia between 2003, 2005, 2011, and until 2015. And because they are considered illegal migrants, their situation is really hopeless. And because there are no diasporic ties, unlike the other refugees that come from neighboring countries, they're really left on their own. And it seems like I'm making up a story, but it's sadly true. A few years ago, there were 90 Palestinian refugees who reported themselves to the police in Indonesia because they had nothing left to survive, not all in bulk. But they started to realize that the only place where they could be safe was like being arrested. And so how did we get there? Because among the people I've met, there are wealthy Palestinians who have been in Saudi Arabia, their families have been in Saudi Arabia, in other places in the Gulf for 50 years, and now they're forced to leave. Where are they going to go? So this is why I'm saying it's important to understand why there is no shame in still saying, using the stateless framework to protect Palestinian refugees. This brings us to the question of the relationship between Palestinian refugees and Arab countries and the unsettling solidarity that Arab, I wouldn't say Arab people, but Arab authorities have shown toward Palestinian refugees. Because in general, the status and treatment...
You have all the time it takes.
Okay. The Palestinian refugees have enjoyed different status and treatment based on when they arrived and the political climate toward them in the various countries, the socioeconomic status they had upon arrival, and the family, political, religious, clan affiliations, and also the shifting attitudes toward the Palestinian leadership, the PLO back then. So why? Welcoming Palestinians in the 50s and in the 60s, because Palestinians from Syria, Jordan, Lebanon have soon moved over other countries, becoming a driving workforce which has animated the most of the economic scene in the Middle East, because they were qualified, they were trained, and those coming through Arma School were excellent teachers in high demand from Morocco to the Gulf countries. And so there was a general predisposition toward the Palestinians. They were not to be granted nationality, no, because this was their way to preserve the right to return. But they were given a permit to enter and to stay, travel document to move across the region, residency permit, and so on. The Casablanca Protocol of 1965 and other, the League of Arab States has designed a fantastic regime on paper to protect Palestinian refugees, which has ceased to operate the moment the tide, the political attitude toward the PLO changed. Then the Arab government started to display vindictive attitude toward the Palestinian people. And I'm going to say something that it sounds shocking to many, but it seems so obvious to us who have studied historically the displacement of Palestinians refugees across the world now. After the original displacement of 750,000 Palestinians in 1948 and 300,000 Palestinians in 1967, from British Mandate Palestine first, and from what remained of British Palestine next, the largest displacement of Palestinians has occurred from Arab countries. Between the 90s and present day, about 700,000 Palestinians have been forcibly displaced. Yes. And it includes the 350,000 Palestinians from Kuwait in 1990s, when to protest against Yasser Arafat's decision not to condemn Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. From night to day, Palestinians were displaced, but even before this, displaced, dispossessed, object of serious human rights violations, and many of them have never returned. They lost whatever they had built. It was extremely serious. And then it has happened from Lebanon, and it has happened from Iraq. Iraq had 70,000 Palestinians pre-2003. Now there are 7,000. Under 20,000 have been displaced since the beginning of the war in Syria from Syria. And of course, I mean, this is just to give you the sense, this is why we talk about the displacement. So for many, displacement have become a fact of life. And what we think we have managed to put together through our legal analysis is an account of Palestinian dispersal that provides the story of a nation in exile fragmented by the exile, where the realities they experience are a constant challenge to legal categories and to common assumptions. Palestinians are distinct, but not much, because of the legal regime that goes with them or the special arrangements I just mentioned to you, but because it's what it means for a Palestinian being to be a refugee. It's what Edward Said said, and I cannot find a better way to see that, orphans of a homeland, which was wiped off the maps with the creation of the State of Israel and no longer exist except in the millions of pieces and fragments of the exile. So it's the Palestinian identity which is what still holds together many across this 50 countries. And this is why we challenge in our book the perception that the refugees are just passive recipients of aid, international assistance, languishing in refugee camps while waiting for a solution. This is wrong. This is just, it's not even a minority, it's just wrong. Because while refugees are not Palestinians in general, and the refugees are not masters of their own life, they've contributed significantly to the search for justice through political and legal activism, from grassroots organization to the PLO mission in New York. So we hope that by setting the legal narrative in the historical context as we have done, and by showing how the move that of hundreds of thousands from the original host countries through all corners of the world demanding justice, the reader will get a sense of how compelling is the use of international laws to get out of the impasse. And I was planning to tell you a little bit of how we deal in the last chapter with looking forward and the quest of solution, just and durable solution, but I will just provide a hint because I know that Lex is eager to elaborate on that. We do see opportunities coming forward. Although the situation is quite depressing, and let's say that the US administration is not making it better, but there are opportunities that are to be seized. But to get there, as we propose, a paradigm shift is necessary. We need to use all the means we have to make sure that the Palestinian refugee question is brought back to the debate, because as Eugene was mentioning, it's disappearing. There is sort of amnesia. And no, we hope that with the book, we will, as I was saying in the beginning, we will stimulate discussion on how important, and we cannot be silent about that trade union between the past and the present. And also, while the American administration in Israel are seeking to impose solutions that make international law fully relevant, not only we explain why it's relevant to lawyer, but because we think that without addressing the question of historical and protracted and enduring injustice that the Palestinians have suffered, not only there can't be justice for the Palestinians, but there cannot be peace in the Middle East. And I'll stop here.
Thank you.
Next, we pass the baton back
to you. Yeah. Thank you, Francesca. And I would like to use our remaining time to elaborate on what Francesca just said, and in particular, how the New York Declaration on Refugees and Migrants, adopted in late 2016, anonymously by the General Assembly, not a single abstention, not a single vote against, and the subsequent Global Compact of 2018, how these documents together represent a unique opportunity to advance solutions for Palestinian refugees. And as Francesca said, you know, when I wrote the first edition of the book, there was the Oslo process. So that provided the framework for, you know, looking at a solution of the refugee issue. When we started writing the final chapter on solutions of the new book, there was no framework. I mean, the peace process had collapsed. Oslo was, you know, had turned out to be a trap. We were really lost. And so when we reflected on sort of try to draw the lessons learned from the 20 years since Oslo and essentially the 70 years since the Nakba, we came to the conclusion, you know, something fundamentally has to change. And hence our suggestion for a paradigm shift back to the UN, back from the, you know, originally the refugee issue was thrown by the UK in the leap of the UN, and it was the UN that had worked for solutions. And then through Oslo, it got to essentially a bilateral process. And so that has to end. It has to get back to the UN, back to the centrality of international law for the reasons that Francesca has mentioned, and also moving away from what American anthropologist Neil Gabian calls sort of the politics of suffering, you know, the perception that in order to preserve the right of return, you know, refugees cannot seize other solutions, other opportunities. So that's what we feel sort of needs to change. And the New York Declaration, we believe, presents a unique opportunity to move forward. And I just will mention a number of key sort of reasons why, which are elaborated in much greater detail in our final chapter. Firstly, nothing in the text of the New York Declaration and the Global Compact implies that Palestinian refugees are excluded from its scope. And on the contrary, several references in the text make it clear that New York Declaration does, in fact, apply to them. Secondly, the New York Declaration and the Global Compact address two of the three elements of our proposed paradigm shift. It emphasizes that the UN, primarily through UNHCR, but not excluding UNRWA, as the New York Declaration is applicable to Palestinians, and UNRWA is actually explicitly mentioned, is responsible for the pursuit of solutions to refugee problems and assistance to refugee problems and their protection. And it reaffirms the central role of international law and the importance of a multi-stakeholder approach in resolving refugee problems. So by simply referring to the New York Declaration, we have a very powerful tool to get back where we believe, you know, the Palestinian refugee question should be. And neither of this is new, but what is new is that the New York Declaration and the Global Compact endorse action to promote durable solutions, particularly in protracted refugee situations, with a focus on sustainable and timely return in safety and dignity. So, you know, it also helps us to, you know, reaffirm the primacy of return in the Palestinian case. Of direct relevance to Palestinian refugees, the provision in New York Declaration that solutions should not necessarily be conditions on accomplishment of political solutions in the country of origin. So also here, the New York Declaration is urging us to think out of the box. Certainly, the New York Declaration and the Global Compact set out what is called a comprehensive refugee response framework, the CRRF, as in abbreviated, which is to be developed for each situation involving a large movement of refugees, including in protected situations. Comprehensive refugee response framework, a framework for the protection, for assistance to refugees, for the pursuit of durable solutions, for burden sharing and asserting the responsibilities of the different stakeholders, the host countries, the countries of asylum, the international community, etc. So far, 15 of those CRRFs have been elaborated, or elements thereof, mostly led by UNHCR, primarily led by UNHCR in different regions of the world, from the Rohingya to the Afghan refugee problem to various refugee problems in Africa. There's no one-size-fits-all CRRF. Each must reflect the specific of the problem it addresses. Now, because the New York Declaration and the Global Compact apply to Palestinian refugees, they provide a UN-sanctioned mandate with the broadest possible endorsement by the international community. I already mentioned, 193 states have endorsed the New York Declaration, no abstentions, no opposing votes, for the elaboration of a comprehensive response framework for Palestinian refugees. Now, for obvious reason, it has not been appropriate for UNHCR to lead the development of a comprehensive framework for Palestinian refugees. And for a number of reasons, including the unprecedented financial crisis following Trump's decision to defend UNRWA, to date also UNRWA has not been in a position to seize the opportunity. Given the respective responsibilities of the two agencies, we propose in our book that both agencies work together and agree on a common strategy for creating a single comprehensive response framework for Palestine refugees. Each agency could then develop and implement a part that covers the refugees, the Palestinian refugees for which it is responsible. And they could consider appointing a special coordinator to ensure the integration of the two parts of the framework. Once again, the broadest possible UN General Assembly mandate to pursue this has been in place since the New York Declaration was adopted. And we believe that the imminent appointment of a new UNRWA Commissioner General might signal the appropriate time to move forward. Fourthly and finally, one may ask, in what way would such a proposed framework differ from other initiatives to try to solve the Palestinian refugee question in the past and that have, got us nowhere? We believe the answer to that is as much in the process of the development of the framework as it is in the results. Firstly, the multi-stakeholder approach called for in the New York Declaration would mobilize all relevant actors, including the Palestinians, including the host countries, including other states, including the UN, including grassroots organizations, and importantly put the Palestinians in the driving seat, surveying and ensuring participation of the Palestinian refugee population and the global Palestinian diaspora must be given priority, and we envisage this as part of the development of the framework. In developing it, the Palestinian refugee movement would provide an important complement to the Palestinian political leadership. Efforts must also be made to involve elements of Israeli society that are open to this in the elaboration of the framework. And difficulties in securing Israel's more formal engagement should not prevent progress on the framework. The process would entail consultation at the national, regional, and international levels, structured engagement with refugees, and exploring the feasibility of various solutions and other measures. Dealing with the past is normally a post-conflict measure, and Francesca was already referring to it on a number of places in her presentation. It's normally a post-conflict measure to rebuild societal trust and promote reconciliation. For the Palestinians, it is necessary to address the past now, to restore dignity, to enhance their sense of national identity, and allow them to move forward as a people. We therefore propose that the framework provide for the establishment of an objective historical account of the origin of Palestinian displacement, including its constituent elements, causes, and evolution. Then the work of the UNCCP and past discussions on restitution and compensation have highlighted the challenges of identifying and evaluating Palestinian property that has been transformed, absorbed into Israel's economy, and classified and reclassified under a variety of Israeli laws. The lessons of other important precedents, including that of Israeli claims for compensation from Germany, have shown that such challenges are not insurmountable and that the practical challenges should not prevent further exploration in the Palestinian case. And during the peace process, there was quite a bit of sort of consideration of compensation mechanisms. In this context, the UNCCP records and their ongoing digitization by the Institute for Palestine Studies, with the potential for linkages with the UNRWA registration records, may advance the prospects of restitution when possible and compensation where it is not. Last but not least, addressing the Palestinian refugee question within the framework of international law means aligning the search for solutions back with international refugee law and practice. This includes the primacy of repatriation, and as the book makes clear, the right to return to modern-day Israel is firmly grounded in international law as it stood in 1948. The proposed third element of our paradigm shift, you know, moving away from this politics of suffering, entails that the other two durable solutions, local integration in host countries and resettlement in third countries, be given further consideration as well. A combination of the durable solutions has helped resolve other protracted refugee situations and could help to do so for the Palestinian refugees as well. In this context, the framework should make it clear that under international law, the ending of refugee status for those willing to be integrated locally or be resettled is the consequence of a cessation of their need for international protection. It does not affect the right of return, restitution, and compensation under international law and UN resolutions. We have no illusion that the obstacles in moving the above vision forward are formidable. However, the deaths of the two-state solution, which received a further blow by Trump's deal of the century, combined with the complete absence of progress in resolving the Palestinian refugee question, call for new thinking and new approaches. Doing nothing is no longer an option, and the New York Declaration provides a powerful new opportunity to the United Nations for redressing the plight of the Palestinian refugees. It is our sincere hope that it be seized before too long. Thank you very much. We're now happy to take your questions.